This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hamas condemned a recent security pact signed between Morocco and Israel, calling the agreement a great sin against the Palestinian cause. Several European countries announced the first cases of a highly infectious new variant of COVID-19 as the UK toughens restrictions to stem spread of Omicron. And police in Burkina Faso fired tear gas to disperse protesters, calling for the resignation of President Roch Marc Christian Kabore. Hello, everybody. A very warm welcome to World News. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called on Morocco to sever ties with Israel after Rabat signed a security deal with the regime. Now, Hamas has condemned the agreement as a great sin against the Palestinian cause. It says the move is against the strategic goals of the Arab world and cannot be justified under any pretext. On Wednesday, Morocco and Israel signed an agreement for security, intelligence, and military cooperation between the two sides. The agreement was signed during a visit by the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, to the North African country. Morocco normalized ties with the Israeli regime last year under a U.S. brokered deal. Political commentator Paul Larudi says the normalization between some Arab countries and Israel is poor short-term strategy aimed at only limited and immediate gains.
It's basically these nations looking out for themselves. At least they think that they're looking out for themselves. In actual fact, by giving up on the Palestinians and on the states that continue to support the Palestinians, they're dividing the Arab world in which they live and the region of the world where they do. And they're giving powers to the imperialist nations from outside that want to destroy these nations. And to put, nations against nations, such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria and Iraq and Iran, and Yemen. This is a means of splitting and destroying and consuming the resources of the countries of the so-called Middle East or West Asia and North Africa, and this is a very poor strategy. It's a very short-term strategy for limited and immediate gains.
Now, November 27th marks the first anniversary of Israel's assassination of prominent Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. That was part of Israel's long-running objectives to hamper advancements made in Iran's nuclear program, but anti-Iran plots have proven ineffective as Tehran continues to make progress with its peaceful nuclear program.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the former head of the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated on November 27, 2020, when the car he was riding in came under attack near his countryside residence east of Tehran. Fakhrizadeh had reportedly been on Israel's hit list since at least 2007.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But he wasn't the only Iranian scientist to have been targeted by Israel. The regime made several assassination attempts between 2007 and 2012 that claimed the lives of four nuclear scientists and wounded another. That's on top of sabotage attacks on Iran's nuclear sites that have become more frequent over the past months, Iran has vowed to continue the work on its peaceful nuclear program. The international community, however, was largely silent over the recent assassination, a similar attitude of indifference that displayed toward Israel's airstrikes on Syria and its aggression on the Palestinian people.
The point is simple. Israel is America's most important friend and ally in the Middle East and in North Africa. Israel is exempt from prosecution in the eyes of America simply because without Israel, America's position in the Middle East and in North Africa would be in serious jeopardy.
Iran has vowed a harsh response against those behind the attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists and sites.
Now, American officials have reportedly warned Israel that its attacks on Iran's nuclear program will prove counterproductive. They say the regime's actions have enabled Iran to rebuild an even more efficient enrichment system. Reports say Israel has rejected the U.S. warning, saying it will not shift its anti-Iran policies. This implies Israel may continue targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists.
A report published by the New York Times suggests that the United States has called on Israel to stop its attacks on Iran's nuclear program, suggesting that they could help strengthen Iran's capabilities. The article cites officials familiar with the discussions who said Washington has told Tel Aviv that the attacks are ultimately counterproductive, as Iran has been able to replace the damaged centrifuges with newer and much more capable ones within months. According to the article, the U.S. officials have admitted that Iran has improved its defenses, including with regard to its cybersecurity, rendering an attack similar to the Stuxnet virus extremely difficult to succeed. Israeli officials have reportedly rejected the U.S. call, saying they don't have any intention of ending their anti-Iran policies. Yet the credibility of the whole report is under question, as Washington and Tel Aviv hardly disagree on matters, especially in the case of Iran.
The Americans understand that Israel's actions often cannot be defended publicly, so it cannot always be seen in public as siding with the Israelis. So that is why from time to time the Americans will issue a public statement saying that they have issued a caveat to Tel Aviv about their actions vis-a-vis Lebanon or vis-a-vis Iran.
The report could also be a scare tactic in an attempt to obtain concessions ahead of a key talks in Vienna on the obligations of the parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. But Iran has repeatedly stated its firm position that the talks must end in the removal of all anti-Tehran sanctions.
A new and potentially more transmissible coronavirus strain finds its way to Europe, triggering alarm among European governments. Britain has confirmed two cases of the variant Omicron.
I was contacted by the UK Health Security Agency. I was informed that they have detected two cases of this new variant Omicron in the United Kingdom, one in Chelmsford, the other in Nottingham. The two individuals concerned are self-isolating alongside their whole household, whilst further tests and sequencing is carried out and contact tracing.
The British Health Minister confirms the two cases are linked to travel to South Africa, where the Omicron variant was first detected. He says the government plans to carry out targeted testing and sequencing of positive cases in affected areas. UK has also added four African countries to its travel red list to try to curb spread of Omicron. In addition, arrivals from across the world now have to take a PCR test by the second day of arrival in the UK and self-isolate until they have their negative result. The government is also tightening COVID rules inside the country.
We will require all contacts of those who test positive with a suspected case of Omicron to self-isolate for 10 days, regardless of your vaccination status. We will also go further in asking all of you to help contain the spread of this variant by tightening up the rules on face coverings in shops and on public transport.
Johnson says the new rules are temporary and will be reviewed after 3 weeks. Elsewhere, Italy has detected its first case of the Omicron variant in a traveler from Mozambique. Germany has confirmed 2 cases in the state of Bavaria. 1 suspected case has also been detected in the German state of Hesse. Czech Republic and the Netherlands have each reported 1 suspected case of the new strain. Meanwhile, Hungary says it will impose restrictions on travelers from 7 African countries. EU members have already agreed to impose restrictions on all travel from South Africa. This is while South Africa is enraged by the decision of many world countries to ban flights from there. It says it's being punished and unfairly treated for sounding the alarm. In Burkina Faso, a child and 2 journalists are injured after riot police fired tear gas to disperse anti-government protests. Protesters rallied in Ouagadougou to express frustration at the government's failure to stop militant violence. They demanded President Roch Marc-Christian Kabore step down. Rally was held despite a ban on gatherings and amid a heavy presence of security forces. Angry protesters burned tires in several neighborhoods in an effort to block police movement. Burkina Faso is one of the world's poorest countries, and its armed forces are ill-equipped to tackle highly mobile militants. Anti-French sentiment are running high in the West Africa. Protesters in western Niger have blocked a French military convoy from crossing the border from Burkina Faso. French soldiers and Nigerian military police fired warning shots to disperse protesters who tried to pillage and seize trucks in the border city of Tara. Authorities there say at least 2 protesters were killed and over a dozen injured, most likely by gunshots. The convoy has now managed to continue on its way toward the capital, Niamey. On Friday, armored vehicles and logistics trucks crossed the border into Niger after being blocked in Burkina Faso for a week. France intervened in Mali in 2013 to fight militants, but people in West Africa believe the French forces have failed to stop mounting violence by militants there. Russia has once again rejected Western accusations that it is planning to invade neighboring Ukraine. We discuss this issue in length with our guests in our News Review program. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Russia has once again rejected Western accusations that it is planning to invade neighboring Ukraine. Head of Russia's Foreign Intelligence Agency says he needs to reassure everyone that nothing like this is going to happen. Sergei Naryshkin said suggestion that Moscow may be poised to launch an attack is malicious U.S. propaganda. The remarks came a day after the U.S. State Department's top diplomat for European affairs said all options are on the table in how to respond to Russia's troop buildup along its border with Ukraine. Karen Donfried also said NATO will decide on the next move after consultations next week. U.S. and its Western allies have accused Moscow of preparing an invasion plan. Russia, however, says it is free to move its soldiers throughout its territory and has instead condemned NATO for its provocative acts. Joining us now for the program is Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess I will start there in Bristol with you, Tony. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on the story.
Well, interesting. Sergei Naryshkin from the Foreign Intelligence Service. It's interesting to see the way that the Russians... They realise that this is nonsense that the West is talking about a Russian invasion. And shall I tell you how we know that in the West? People who are switched on. That's because the Western media has been coming up with this story ever since about 1948, 1949. So we're talking now about something like 70 years. We've been being told there's a threat from Russia. The Russia's about to invade. Well, of course, the total opposite is what's taken place. And the NATO forces have actually been moving closer and closer to the borders of Russia and threatening Russia. So the opposite has been taking place as to what they're now saying. Now, of course, when there are potential, maybe with Russian intelligence gets information the West is going to try some sort of a provocation on the border, it would make sense for them to move their troops. But the idea that the Russians are about to invade us, I'm afraid, these people who are saying this are living in fairyland. This is not going to happen. I can categorically say there will be no invasion from Russia. And what may happen, though, is that we may see some sort of provocation going on from and by the West. The Russians are, I think, very a measured nation. There's an Orthodox nation, which actually makes it different to the European Catholic and Protestant type attitudes. I think they're very reliable, basically. We've seen the West threatening Russia, and it is a form of Russophobia, actually. It's a kind of mental illness there seems to be in the West for hundreds of years. We're talking about Napoleon. We're talking about, the attack by Adolf Hitler against the Russians. The West have always actually been the aggressors, and the Russians have generally been on the defensive. And
thank you, Tony. Robert, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Hope you're doing well out there in Kitchener, Ontario. Now, Robert, it's funny because you see NATO and its buildup getting closer and closer to Russia's borders. Multiple countries, you see them flocking into the Black Sea like it's their backyard, yet they're pointing the finger at Russia. It's Moscow that's getting ready to invade and not them.
Yes, this is typical U.S. propaganda. The U.S. is always pointing the finger at someone else before it's ready to invade. The United States is positioning its troops in nearly 1,000 foreign military bases on borders of many countries, almost surrounding Iran, as a matter of fact. So this new accusation is just the typical U.S. policy of having some enemy, something to take away from the attention of the problems of the United States. We have to remember President Biden, his poll numbers are very low. There's talk that the Republicans will take control of the House and Senate next year. And a war is something that, for whatever reason, U.S. citizenry always rallies around. So if the United States can either threaten a war or actually have one, that is politically beneficial for the party in power. Now, as Moscow's foreign intelligence chief mentioned, Russia has the right to position its troops anywhere it wants to within its own country. The United States positions its troops anywhere it wants to within the world. This is a criminal activity, but to accuse Moscow of planning an invasion of the Ukraine because it has moved troops somewhere near the border, when the United States has troops near the borders of countless countries around the world, is simply typical U.S. hypocrisy. We see it continually in U.S. foreign policy.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us once again. Tony Gosling joining us there out of Bristol, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist, joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The United Arab Emirates is rewarding Israeli regime arms makers that helped massacre Palestinians earlier this year. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading UAE rewards Israeli regime firms that supplied arms for Gaza massacre. Stay tuned for more. The United Arab Emirates is rewarding Israeli regime arms makers that helped massacre Palestinians earlier this year. Elbit Systems, which provided weapons for the Zionist regime's May assault on Gaza, is establishing a subsidiary, Elbit Systems Emirates. Ran Karel, an executive at Elbit Systems, said the Abraham Accords provide a sound basis for business collaborations in the region. He is referring to the normalization deals brokered by the United States last year between the Zionist regime, the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Morocco. These countries are important new markets for Elbit Systems, Kirill said. An insight into how the Zionist regime views Arab states as profit centers for its war industry. Elbit boasted in an Arabic language video showcasing its weapons that its technology improves efficiency and protects lives, revealing language from a company whose products have proven efficient at ending Palestinian lives. Elbit Systems was among more than a dozen Israeli regime arms manufacturers that participated in the Dubai Air Show recently. They included the Zionist regime's aerospace industries, IAI and Rafale. These firms are among the leading suppliers of weapons used by the Zionist regime in its attacks against Palestinians. This includes the Zionist regime's 11-day war on Gaza in May, which left 250 Palestinians dead, including more than 60 children. During the attack, the Zionist regime annihilated entire families in their homes. Elbit Systems was directly involved in the Zionist regime's assaults, corporate watchdog Who Profits said. The company is a major exporter of drones. Elbit drones were used by the Zionist regime military during the assault, and Elbit's personnel who worked in an operations room of a new drone unit, Unit 9900. The unit operates two drone fleets, one to inspect and collect intelligence and one to attack targets with the gathered data. In other words, the Gaza Strip was effectively used as a testing ground for new artificial intelligence capabilities developed by Elbit as part of a new military unit, according to Who Profits. The unit conducted over 30 operations, according to an Israeli regime general, as part of an effort to perfect the system, an example of how the Zionist regime routinely uses Palestinians as a guinea pigs for the weapons it later sells to other countries at profit. Use of these artificial intelligence capabilities led the military to declare the onslaught on Gaza as the world's first AI war, the watchdog said. Who Profits attributes the firm's success to its relationship with the Israeli regime military, which enables Elbit to test its products in real time and on Palestinian bodies. Elbit regularly markets its products as battle-proven, a euphemism for how those weapons have been used to kill, injure, and control virtually defenseless Palestinians. Who Profits said it is also a golden marketing tool. Elbit weapons were also used in the Zionist regime's major offensive against Gaza in the summer of 2014. That attack is part of the International Criminal Court's investigation into war crimes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The Israeli regime's military killed an average of 11 Palestinian children per day that summer. The Dubai Air Show brought another military deal between two major Emirati and Israeli regime firms recently. EDGE, one of the largest military contractors in the UAE, has signed a memorandum of understanding with IAI to design and build unmanned military and commercial ships, in other words, naval drones. The CEO of EDGE called it a strategic alliance. The vessels will be used for intelligence gathering, surveillance, border operations, and maritime warfare. Meanwhile, Jordan is reaping the benefits of the Abraham Accords, just as was predicted by the Zionist regime lobby observers. Jordan, the Zionist regime, and the UAE are set to sign a deal that will see a solar farm built on Jordanian land to provide energy to the Zionist regime, journalist Brock Ravid reported. John Kerry, the U.S. climate envoy and former Secretary of State, brokered the deal, Ravid said, citing five Israeli officials without naming them. The UAE will fund the solar farm. In return, the Zionist regime will supposedly build a desalination plant on the Mediterranean coast to provide Jordan with water. Despite cosmetic strains between the Zionist regime and Jordan in recent years, the relationship has, according to Ravid, improved significantly since Naftali Bennett took over as prime minister, even though the Zionist regime hasn't changed any of its policies. This has included Jordan secretly sending warplanes to train alongside the Israeli regime air force just as months after the Zionist regime's massacre of civilians in Gaza. Jordanian air force leaders also recently met with their Israeli regime and Emirati counterparts in Dubai. The Zionist regime and Jordan signed a peace treaty in 1994. Despite there being no restoration of Palestinian rights or an end to the Israeli regime military occupation of the West Bank, including East al-Quds and the Gaza Strip. But despite formal ties between the two regimes, this has never translated into a so-called warm peace among people. The treaty is strongly opposed by the Jordanian public and members of parliament, as is a U.S.-backed gas deal that will see Jordan pay the Zionist regime at least $10 billion over 15 years, money that will undoubtedly contribute to the Zionist regime's ongoing oppression of Palestinians. The Jordanian public and parliament have staunchly opposed the deal since it was signed in 2016 and repeatedly called for its cancellation through campaigns and protests. However, the Jordanian official embrace of the Zionist regime continues to tighten without any regard for public opinion.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one outstanding decision from the side of Iraq's most prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who insisted on its state of neutrality concerning the makeup of the Iraqi future government. We know that they're establishing a new government in Iraq now, and the people have voted. for that, but Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani stated of neutrality in that part. Said Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you this episode. Why do you think Ayatollah al-Sistani decided such a decision?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, we can see the main role of Ayatollah al-Sistani, that he has the role of a leadership amongst the Iraqi nationals, basically. And we can see the way he have saved his nation from the threat of ISIS.
That's right.
You know, when he gave the fatwa of everyone should come out, mm-hmm. and they need to protect themselves and they need to come out for Iraq, basically.
That's right.
And the Sunnis, his fatwa about the Sunnis, that they are just like our body parts. Yes. They're just a part of us, basically. That's what he had. So basically, his status is above all these political, we can say, you know, the fights or the differences that we can see within the political groups. And actually, in Islam, when we look at the Islamic system, within the Islamic system, we have the system of Imam and Ummah, like the leader and the followers, basically.
Yes.
Under this system, which is the basic system of, we can say, Islam, and especially in Shiaism, we follow this system. Ayatollah Sistani is playing the role of the leader at the moment for his nation. And when he's playing the role, then there is no grouping for the followers. But obviously, we are following a secular system where we have this democracy and, you know, these political systems, right and left, I don't know. The Republican and the other ones. So the decision that he made is a wise decision.
Yes.
And those even who are criticizing him basically are unknown to what he is capable of, basically.
That's right.
And they want him to get involved in the little things, little yes. issues
yes.
that they have in between them, which can be solved by the political, we can say, groups by themselves.
Okay.
And there is no need of him supporting anyone.
That's all right. And especially when we look at the country Iraq, I see our Sunni brethren also living over there, you know, and Ayatollah Sistani has always emphasized on the unity among different denominations inside Iraq and all the Muslim lands, and that's why he had made an international figure regarding from the Shia world in Islam. But Said Murtaza, again, you know, this is when, you know, out of the total seats of the, we can say, the parliament, in the parliamentary elections, the Shia ones have won the chairs over there. And Ayatollah Sistani is a Shia, so automatically and technically speaking, it was expected from Ayatollah Sistani to support you know, the Shia ones over there. But he has stated neutrality, again, not getting into the political games and the political scene of Iraq. But at the same time, behind the scene, he has this power of issuing a fatwa against ISIS and Daesh and all the people from different denominations, not only the Shia and the Sunni, but also the non-Muslims come to the scene following him. So this is the power of the Marja'iyya in Iraq. Talk a little bit about this for us.
Well, you know, we have to just again look into the issue of election from two different point of views.
Okay.
First, we know that election looks like a political game.
Mm-hmm.
And anyone involved in the political game puts his political purpose first before any other factors. And we know that Muslims around the world have the same system somehow these days, that they are very much involved in the political issues, and election is one of them.
That's right.
As a kind of election expert, because I used to work with election commission in some countries in Africa and in Asia.
That's right.
I would like to say that the election is a technical process. We have technical campaigns. We have political supports from political parties. But the story looks a little bit different inside Iraq. Because I was actually somehow involved in the election for the first time that took place after that Saddam Hussein as a dictator toppled.
Okay.
So we have this constituency election. We had this constituency election there.
Yes.
You know, we should not forget the great influence and the role of Shia authorities. And this great marja inside Iraq is not going to belittle himself and his role as the only leader who is going to bring the whole nation together when the situation is getting tough.
That's right.
And we had this actually done by Grand Ayatollah Sistani. Yes. And, you know, political game is not a ground for scholars to play.
Yes.
So what they did was a great achievement for the Shia scholars.
Yes.
Because basically we need to look at the bigger picture. What stands more important than anything else inside the country?
Yes.
National integrity and national unity.
Yes.
So if these two factors have been kept and they have been actually maintained,
yes,
especially by a religious scholar,
yes,
it would certainly give this interpretation to every single individual in the country that the whole nation is together.
Yes.
And they are not going to be divided.
That's right.
Let's look if the other things would happen.
Mm-hmm.
If this Grand Ayatollah would actually take a side in the election, so the whole nation will actually fall apart.
Yes.
So, and the system probably will collapse.
Okay.
So in order to prevent more damages, greater damages to the national interest and to the even to the religious interest.
That's right.
So I think great Ayatollah al-Sistani made a great decision.
Yes, that's
and
right.
He and his office openly announced that they're not going to take any sides,
yes,
but they're going to actually look at the whole election
right.
process that must be fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, we have actually different segments,
yes,
political segments,
yes,
in the country that each won some seats.
That's right. Okay. And Said Mohsen, do you think that this decision of Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani will make a kind of religious unity among the Sunni and Shia inside Iraq too?
It is definitely. Obviously, we have these different groups. We should not forget we have Kurds, we have the Sunni denomination, we have the Shia denomination. And as Said Murtaza has mentioned, the scholars, they should not enter into the political, you know, games that the politicians generally have, the groups have, because they come with their own personal, we can say, like, inclinement towards, you know, the thoughts that they have.
That's right.
They have their own plans. And tomorrow, if something goes wrong, the very first person who's going to be blamed,
yes,
is not the political,
yes,
party. It's going to be the Grand Ayatollah.
Yes.
So it was a wise and great decision that he made. And obviously, this will bring unity. And tomorrow, if anything happens or any, we can say, like, if there is a dispute among these parties, Ayatollah Sistani will be the one who can solve these issues the way he did before.
Okay.
You know, obviously, we need to leave a space for someone who can resolve the issues
That's
amongst
right.
the political parties if tomorrow, if something happens and the Iraqi nation needs someone.
Mm-hmm.
So basically,
why is independent reasoning for himself?
Yes.
You know, on presence.
And this is a big decision because tomorrow they will not go after America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to come and do decision, make decision amongst us.
Yes.
They have their own personality. They have their own leader or a Grand Ayatollah who can basically make decision for themselves. So, yes, it is the matter. It will bring a unity amongst all the communities. And obviously, it increases the respect of the Shia school of thought as well.
That's right.
That when such a person at a high state of a school of thought, he plays a role neutral in the election where everything should be neutrally, should be resolved neutrally according to the process which has been defined. So therefore, the unity will increase and the respect amongst the people will increase definitely.
That's all right. And this, as you said, from the side of the Hausa of Najaf, and you know, the Zaim, the main Zaim of the Hausa of Najaf, you know, and all the Shia houses inside Iraq comes, that is Ayatollah al-Sistani. You know, this position has shown that, again, Ayatollah al-Sistani is emphasizing on the national unity and the integrity of Iraq. And as you said, in the harsh decisions that are made, for example, the attack that ISIS made on Iraq, you know, such a personality can really help the people over there. But say, Murtaza, the case is that the Shias inside Iraq are now getting the chairs out of the parliament, the majority of the chairs out of the parliament. But again, they must not be proud of this power, is it so? Because in the next elections, something else might happen. And I think this power shift inside Iraq and the balance has to be taken care of, because the population over there is not the only Shia one.
Well, you know that if you look at the primary results of the count, you would see that the whole ballot papers have been counted, and the political parties, usually the three major ones, won some seats from this election.
Yes.
And the only political party that won actually like two-thirds of the seats were the Shiite ones.
Yes.
And it shows that the majority of the people, the majority of the eligible voters actually voted for the Shiites.
Right.
So it shows that it's a great opportunity for the Shiite political parties, not only one, because we have another political Shiite political party that won around 37 seats.
Yes.
So altogether it's more than like 100 seats.
Yes.
And it was allocated to the Shiite political parties. It's a great opportunity. It shows that Shiites must take this opportunity and use it in order to benefit the whole Iraqi nation.
Iraqi nation.
And, you know, in Iraq we have other religions too,
yes.
other followers too.
Yes.
We have even Christians.
Yes.
We have other yes. followers of other religions. So Shiite must draw a very authentic picture of religious freedom.
Yes.
Unfortunately, religious freedom is not a popular term in Western parts of the world. So they say we don't have religious freedom. But what has been happening in some countries like Iraq now, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and some other countries, we have religious freedom.
Yes.
So this freedom must be practiced.
Yes.
And I think Shiite political parties now has that chance, and they have to grab that chance and to show to other followers of other religions that Shiites are not very much closed-minded.
Yeah, so they even inside Islamic Republic of Iran's parliament, we have representatives from the Sunni Brethren, from Zoroastrians, from we can say the even the Kalimi ones, you know, the Armenians, you know, they have their own representative inside our parliament inside Iran.
So this shows that the Grand Ayatollah Sistani made a very effective decision, and his role is not going to be ignored in order to increase, advance, boost national unity and national integrity.
Okay, Said Mohsen, any comments?
Well, I just wanted to add that, you know, when we see Ayatollah Sistani being neutral, we should, when we're talking about the election of the Iraq, we should also have a neutral role, or maybe let's take out this discussion from the sectarian, you know, discussion from a general discussion that the Iraqi nation had the election.
Yes.
There are some parties, you know, obviously the parties, maybe they're like Shia and Sunni. We are just saying that, but it, I think it's not good to mention Shia and Sunni.
Really?
Well, a party has won most of the votes because, you know, if you look at the population, Shias are in majority.
Yes.
So if we say like they have won more seats, and what about the Sunnis? This is not good.
Okay.
Basically, in Iraq, there's a special like party which is related to the Sadr family.
Yes.
There are the other parties which are related to other tribes. Because another thing in Iraq, we have this tribal system as well.
Yes.
So basically, if we put forward this word as that most of the, you can say like the votes or the seats have been taken by the Sadr tribe, and this party has taken it, that would be better, rather than saying if Shias are coming, what's going to happen, or Ayatollah Sistani is Shia, because, you know, the role and the statement of Ayatollah Sistani tells us or teaches us that you should not use such words, because you should use a word which tells that within Iraq there are two parties, and a party has got more votes, what he can do.
But any group, regardless of any, we can say, sectarian look that we have, if comes to the power, has to observe the rise of all in
that's,
Iraq,
that's much
whether
important.
Being Sunni or Shia one. That's right. Okay, this is the point. Thank you, my Said Mohsen and Said Murtaza, for presence in the program Viewpoints. We talked about Grand Ayatollah Sistani's decision on its state of being neutral concerning the makeup of the future government in Iraq. It was very kind of you, and thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources, while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States, says Julie Hollar, writer, in an article titled Missing Voices in Broadcast Coverage of Afghan Withdrawal. Stay tuned for more. As the U.S., after 20 years, finally began its withdrawal from Afghanistan, the story dominated TV news. Just as they did when the war began, corporate journalists overwhelmingly leaned on government and military sources while offering no clear anti-war voices and vanishingly few perspectives from civil society leaders in either Afghanistan or the United States. FAIR studied a week of Afghanistan coverage, starting with the day the Taliban took back Kabul. FAIR looked at the three prime-time broadcast news shows, ABC World News Tonight, CBS Evening News, and NBC Nightly News, identifying 74 sources across the three shows. Of these sources, 23 sources were Afghans, 20 were identified as Afghan-Americans, and 31% of all sources. Only 11 of these 23, fewer than half, were identified by at least a first name, and only 4 were women. Afghans often have only one name. While 3 Afghan sources were identified as professionals who might have offered informed commentary on the broader political or historical situation, a journalist, a member of parliament, and a nonprofit director, the vast majority of questions to all Afghan and Afghan-American sources were about their personal risk and situation, essentially providing color rather than expert opinion to the story. Americans who were not Afghans comprised the remaining 51 sources, with no other nationalities represented. Of these, U.S. sources 31 were non-Pentagon government officials, and 16 were current or former military, from the Secretary of Defense to enlisted troops. The remainder were three parents of Americans killed in the war, and the non-Afghan U.S. citizens evacuating from Afghanistan. The partisan breakdown of U.S. officials was 29 Democrats to 8 Republicans, with President Joe Biden accounting for 14 of the Democratic sources and other members of his administration accounting for 12. No scholars or anti-war activists from either the U.S. or Afghanistan were featured. Only two civil society leaders made appearances: the director of a nonprofit women's organization in Afghanistan and the president of a New York City veterans organization. Despite the media's emphasis on the plight of women in Afghanistan as a result of U.S. withdrawal, women were rarely considered experts or even voices worth hearing on this story. Only 8 sources were female, 11% of the total, 2 of whom were unnamed. And corporate journalists themselves, who have often been the loudest cheerleaders for Afghanistan war, continued their jingoism in the face of the withdrawal. NBC's chief foreign correspondent Richard Engel, for instance, offered an echo of rather than a counterpoint to McConnell and Abdul. A 20-year war, the longest in U.S. history, today ended a disgrace. The U.S. leaving behind a country its citizens are too terrified to live in. Similarly, CBS Nora O'Donnell declared, "When America leaves, for many, so does the hope of freedom, the hope for human rights, and in place comes the sheer terror of what's next." O'Donnell went on to detail the number of Americans killed and wounded, plus the unspecified cost to America's national security. Given that the withdrawal was an acknowledgement that after 20 years of occupation, the U.S. had little control over what kind of country it would be leaving behind, it's hardly to imagine a withdrawal that Engel would not have considered a disgrace. But while he and O'Donnell highlighted the plight of many Afghans, neither made any mention of the number of Afghans killed or wounded in the 20-year war, which was at least 27 times higher than U.S. casualties, according to the Cost of War Project at Brown University. That project estimated that at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed, including more than 500 humanitarian workers and journalists, along with over 69,000 national military and police and more than 52,000 opposition fighters. But these tallies, which do not even include the wounded or excess, I mean, and direct death, are almost certainly undercounts. New Yorker reporter Anand Gopal, who has spent years covering the war, including time in rural Afghanistan, believes that the available death tolls have grossly undercounted civilian casualties, as much of the ongoing conflict has taken place in outlying areas where deaths frequently go unrecorded. Gopal's recent article, New Yorker, on rural Afghan women recounted his investigation in the largely rural Helmand province, where he interviewed a random selection of 12 households, finding that each had lost, on average, 10 to 12 civilians to the war. While the Taliban rule was not popular among those he interviewed, it was clearly preferred to U.S. occupation, which had empowered even more ruthless warlords and ensured unending conflict, airstrikes, and terror in the region. This perspective was not to be found on U.S. TV news coverage of the withdrawal, with its correspondents reporting from the airbase in Kabul and Afghanistan, a world apart from that known by the majority of the country's population. NBC's Lester Holt, who visited Afghanistan in 2010 and 2012, offered a typical assessment, painting the occupation as a sensitive operation bringing Afghanistan out of darkness into a brighter future, saying, "Traveling across Afghanistan a decade into the war in 2012, it was hard not to feel some optimism as if we were witness to a country emerging from darkness. Through the war, epic American-led battles reclaimed cities and villages from the Taliban. U.S. commanders nurtured trust among village elders believing in Afghanistan's future. And now, in the chaos, we are left to wonder how that future has been so rapidly rewritten with the chapters from Afghanistan's past." 2 weeks later, on the eve of the official withdrawal, CBS O'Donnell asked longtime Pentagon correspondent David Martin, "What does this moment mean?" Martin responded, "To me, it's on all of us as American citizens. We as a country could not summon the will to outlast the Taliban. We sent more than 800,000 troops to fight in the war. The vast majority of them did everything we asked of them. They would have gone back for another 20 years if we had asked them. But the country grew tired of the war, and they elected political leaders, both Democratic and Republican, who wanted to end it. History will decide whether that was right or wrong. But either way, Nora, it's on us." Unquote. Perspectives of U.S. troops were occasionally presented, but segments featuring veterans' voices seemed largely intended to reassure viewers that the 20-year war was worth it. Some veterans are thinking, was it worth it? Were U.S. sacrifices worth it? O'Donnell said, followed immediately by a soundbite from a veteran. "It was worth it. We gave Afghanistan 2 decades of freedom. It made the world a better place," unquote. Notably, post-9/11 veterans had soured on the war over the past decade. While a 2011 Pew poll found that 50% believed the Afghanistan war had been worth fighting, the outfit's 2019 poll found that the number had dropped to 38%, roughly on par with the general public. Afghanistan veterans were more likely than the general public to support the withdrawal. 58% versus 52%, even after it was well underway and the subject of widespread one-sidedly hostile media coverage in morning consult.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.